Hi folks, it's Ray. We've enjoyed the correspondence that we've been receiving from you, and we feature some of it on this episode. But what we'd really like is for you to come and get involved. Diversity is what drives transformation, and we think, apart from anything else, diversity of opinion is one of the most amazing things about humankind. So here's our invite to you. Come along, get involved, give us your opinion, share your experiences, email us at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. Enjoy the show. It's just so incredible. Gotta have it, can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know that this is incredible. Now have you ever wondered how the best did it? They never second guessed, they didn't set limits. Are you a follower? Or a visionary, can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission, listen, it's beyond description. We don't want to fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need a brand of passion that you can't imagine. Don't hesitate, rub the lamp a lad. Hi folks, welcome to Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast. You're listening to episode 3. I'm Ray.
And I'm Gary.
Hi Gary, how you doing?
Hi Ray, very good, thanks.
So, Gary, what have you been up to the last couple of weeks? You've been on a little bit of a break.
Yes, I had a what I call a short break, although it might not have been quite the restful break I thought it was going to be, as in 5 days I covered 796 miles in the car, visiting family and friends on a whistle-stop tour, which took me from the southeast to the southwest, up to the northwest, across into Derbyshire, and then back down through the sort of Bedfordshire, sort of then London, and then back to Kent. So all in 5 days.
That's a hell of a carbon footprint, Gary.
That is, yeah, yeah. It's so I'll have to do my calculate how much I need to give back to the planet for that one. But it was, it was a good trip, really interesting to see some new places as well as some familiar ones. So I was down in sort of Somerset and had a little jaunt down to Lyme Regis, the Dorset coast, and then up to Chester and then across through to sort of Belper in Derbyshire, which is just below the Peak District, and yeah, then catching up with an old trekking friend in Bedfordshire. So really good trip.
It's a nice part of the country, the southwest. I've actually never been, despite the fact that most people, when they try to guess where I'm from, they think I'm from the west country somewhere because of my weird accent. But I've never actually been further west than Bristol, which is quite strange.
Oh, right. Yes. Well, that Bristol, I went to Bristol as well, and Bristol is very good.
I love Bristol. Bristol's a great night out.
It's, there's plenty going on, really good. It's like most cities, you know, if you've got a car, be prepared for a slow march around. very good. And yeah, the West Country is beautiful. So I actually know the West Country reasonably well. So Devon, particularly, but also bits of Cornwall and Somerset. It's all beautiful country, and during the summer it just get really, really busy, so it's quite nice to go out during the winter and see the roads busy but not crazy busy, and just enjoy actually some pretty good weather actually. So
this time of the year you don't get stuck behind caravans and stuff like that so much?
Not so much. You still have all the lorries and the vans to contend with, as ever, delivering all the Christmas presents for people. It's not, the road's not too bad. So you still find roadworks everywhere and other things. There's always something to slow you down. It can be nice if it's not raining, if it's just sort of cold, but you get that crisp sunshine. It's a really nice time to be out on the roads because it is a little bit quieter. You can get to places, but you can also have a chance to have a look around and see things.
Beautiful. And you've been working as well in and around all that?
Yeah, in and around that, still doing a mix of my work. I mean, much of that has been around writing some sales pages and providing some consultation sessions around content and strategy. And so that's really interesting. And I'm just, so this week I'm now going to be reviewing some of the pages to see how they now look now that the client has put them up. So we'll see if we can just do anything more just to tweak those to give them some improvement. But that was interesting that it, even though that project was largely around writing, also through that the client was also able to get some sales strategy advice from me and to look at how they can present a couple of little offers just based on, you know, what I was looking at. So that was really good to be able to provide that as a little bonus for them.
How's the documentaries coming for TEDx?
Yes, still in edit mode for TEDx Folkestone, our little mini documentary. So I have another session on Wednesday, but for our film, we're getting very, very close now to having a really strong draft that will just need some either sort of cutting to length or just providing the music and the titling. So we had a good couple of sessions in recent weeks just putting together. Our event is our documentary is a three-act piece, and we've now got three acts in place, and it's just going through, and it's more a case of refining it, seeing if there are things that we can just improve, sharpen up a little bit. But it's, yeah, that's all looks as if it's much more on track and how we want it. So that's going to be, yeah, hopefully we'll have something out in December, I think. That's the aim.
And how are they going to be released? Are they coming out on the TEDx Folkestone website?
Yes, the aim will be to release them online. So I'm not quite sure how that will be done first, but yes, at some point they'll want to have those up on the TEDx Folkestone website. You may also be able to see them on YouTube, and they may also have some other channels that they're looking at, although they may have to be reformatted. And by reformatted, I mean cut down to a specific length so that they can go on those particular channels. So we'll see, play that by ear, really, to see if there are channels that are saying, yes, we want them, however it needs to be, this format, this length, then we'll make the necessary cuts.
Yeah, if you can reasonably do that whilst at the same time not foregoing any of the quality or any of the extraordinary content.
Yes, I mean, the idea from the very beginning was to have the option really for a couple of versions of each mini documentary. So one, it would be like the director's cut, which would be, this is showing, if you like, the full version, and then to have another version which might be a shortened version and carry the essence of that fuller piece.
So you've been busy times, even with taking some time off, trying to take some time off.
Yes,
but to be honest with you, Gary, sounds like more of an actual job than like you should have stayed at home and just relaxed.
Yeah, well, I do feel as if I need a holiday, so that may be a little lesson for the
We'll
future.
Choose somewhere warm. Maybe yeah. we'll do a Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast, from Benidorm or somewhere nice and warm. You know, take Leaders That's and Managers it. Hub on the road.
That's it. Management from Malaga. And
so, you know, if any of our listeners happen to own, you know, holiday hotels or anything in nice warm climates, and you want us to come and do a podcast from your business, we're more than happy to do that.
And Razor, and how about you? What have you been up to?
So obviously we released episode 2, and we also released the interview with Dave Burton from QBH Solutions. So Bella and I have been pretty busy trying to sort out, you know, push that through the social media and stuff, and indeed get the social media to a place where we want it to be. And, you know, we're going to try and encourage people to engage with us via those different platforms. So that's been quite interesting. did another interview, which will be coming out in the next 3 or 4 weeks. Just got to edit that up. And work-wise, personally, you know, just sort of flat out delivering this project we've got on the railway. So, yeah, busy times. Busy, busy. Oh, and Friday night, so we're recording this on the 24th of November. And it's going to be, obviously, you're listening to it now on the 2nd of December. And I went to a show at the Leescliffe Hall on Friday called Ultimate Buble, which... which was good. Unfortunately, the place was less than half full, which made a massive difference. You know, it's these things are obviously an awful lot more enjoyable when there's a full crowd. But you know, the music was great. He's a really good singer, the guy, and yeah, we thoroughly enjoyed it, to be quite honest with you. It was a three-way toss-up. So we'd booked it like quite a while ago. And then, obviously, the election got called and they were having the leaders' debates on Friday evening. So I, unfortunately, had to miss that. All the shame. but also, they had the switch on of the lights in Folkestone Town Centre and they had the fireworks down on the Harbour Arms. So I didn't get to see that either, which is a bit unfortunate because I do like a firework. But, you know, hey, you can't spread yourself too thin. I had a good old sing song at the Ultimate Buble, so it was good. So yeah. That's our weeks then. Lots going on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Incredible. So Gary, we've had some correspondence this week to podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com.
Yes, indeed we have, right? And the first one that I want to talk about is an email from Adam. And Adam wrote in and said, "Hi guys, I listened with some interest to your first podcast and in particular, your take on high-performing teams. Ray mentioned that the best leaders he had experienced cared deeply about everybody in the team and was able to show empathy to all in the team. This has been my philosophy for some time," says Adam. "I've always cared about any of the team that I have led in the delivery of a project, and this has applied to the entire team, from the PM to the cable puller out on site. It is critical, in my view, that we all care about each other. So when things get tough, we instinctively pull together and support each other, not because we are told to, but because we want to." And Adam goes on, "Now, the last two major companies I've worked for, I've been fortunate enough to gain promotions into what they would describe as the senior management team, SMT. However, on both occasions, I've been spoken to by the CEO and told that I am too close to my team, that I care too much. For one of the companies, I was actually told to move desks as I should not be sitting with the team. I should be seated away from them to show seniority. I can only assume that these CEOs believed that because I care about the people in my team, I would not be able to take the tough decisions should that need arise, or maybe the decisions I make would be in the best interest of the team and not necessarily in the best interests of the business. I have to say, firstly, I always disagreed with this position and always want to be embedded deeply in any team I lead, but also have to recognise that I have the deepest of respect for both of these CEOs who themselves have been very successful. So maybe I'm being naive or not seeing the bigger picture. I would welcome your views on this."
So first of all, Adam, some interest, really. Not like avid or total or completely immersed interest. We're going to have to do better than that. Thank you for your correspondence, Adam. I mean, Gary, there's quite a lot in there, to be quite honest. We don't necessarily understand the context in which Adam is explaining his particular issue. I noticed he talked about cable pullers, so I'm suggesting he comes from a construction background. I recognize the term because I started out life as a cable puller. And he also talks about having respect for PMs. I can tell you as a PM, nobody likes us. We're just used to it. We don't care. You know, we're like the Millwall of project teams, us project managers. But seriously, I mean, so he talks about that he likes to be close to his teams. And that's absolutely laudable and I would suggest essential. But he talks about that on two occasions it was suggested to him that he was too close to his team, in that he maybe wasn't then able to make the hard decisions. I mean, what are your thoughts on that straight away?
Yes, I mean, I have some empathy with this, because I do think that from my own point of view, if I'm with a team, then I want to be close to that team and I want to feel as if I am part of that team. And if I was the in a leadership role there, yes, people know that I'm in that role there, but that doesn't mean that I have to sit at a specific desk or sit in a specific office to say, you know, I am the one with the power. I'm more interested in how do I work best with the team, and I would like to think that I am part of that team, and therefore not just in a working sense and an emotional sense, but also in a physical sense. So from my point of view, I don't think that the one necessarily means the other, that you have to have that physical separation to allow you to make the teamwork. Mm-hmm. And in terms of making decisions, that's a slightly more complicated thing. But I think if somebody is able to demonstrate that they are getting the team working, that they're performing well, they're getting the results, they're getting the outcomes, then the how they do it, to me, I'd be saying, well, clearly the decisions are being made to get those outcomes, those results. So what's the issue?
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I read Adam's email, the first thing I thought was, well, we don't necessarily understand the context there, but going back into like our experience. So I remember once I was had a project management position, and when I started, they gave me my own little office, which was sort of off of the main office. And I think I lasted in there about 3 days, and I couldn't stand the sound of myself. So I moved out into the main office because I actually felt detached. And maybe that was partly as a result of the way I had sort of come up through the ranks, that I felt I needed to be out among the team and engaging with them constantly, albeit that I didn't feel that being in an office made me any less accessible, but I just felt that it was an unnecessary barrier. You know, if I needed to do something that needed a bit of sensitivity or a bit of privacy, then, you know, I had facility to do that. I could book a meeting room, or I could then use that office. But from a day-to-day basis, I much preferred to be out among the team, because apart from anything else, you get a vibe for what's going on. And, you know, you get to build up those relationships. There's not a physical barrier between you and the rest of your team. I can understand how... So one of the things that's uniquely human, I think, is sometimes as well, if we can't imagine ourselves doing something, or we see something that we feel for ourselves would be a challenge, we're unable to understand how somebody else could operate effectively in that situation. So perhaps maybe those circumstances that Adam refers to maybe tell you a little bit more about those CEOs than it does about Adam. Because maybe their experience is that they wouldn't be as effective in the same situation. We don't know. But, you know, there could be a little bit of an element of that of, well, I don't see how you could do it, so therefore it's not possible. A bit disappointing, maybe, for somebody to have that attitude, but we do it all the time as humans. You know, somebody says, oh, I'm going to climb the Matterhorn, and you're like, there's no way you're ever going to do that. And actually what we're saying is, there's no way I could do that. And we do that subconsciously, and it is something that we need to be mindful of in our interactions, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what we personally think. It's how somebody ultimately performs in that thing.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering whether it's something to do with, you know, tradition and history. So in you know, businesses and organizations in the past, you would have had buildings with offices and separate offices for the hierarchy. So, and that was part of the thing. Oh, you know, you get to a certain stage, you get your own office, and then when you get promoted, you get the bigger office or a better office, and so on and so forth. So whether there's something around that where some people have grown up with that kind of environment, whereas a lot of modern offices now are more different. There's much more open plan, for example. When I was in journalism working in newsrooms, it's all open plan. So you're sitting, you know, very close to the news editor. You can often see the editor as well. When they come in and have their little conferences, sometimes some papers had those in a little office, and others they would actually just go to a corner of the open plan newsroom and they would just have it there, and then people would go back to their different sections within that big room. But the functions and the performance was the same. It didn't really make any difference to, you know, your work as a journalist, as a reporter.
Yeah, it brings to mind a situation that I experienced relatively recently, where it was a project delivery team, upwards of 60 people, open plan office. And I feel that in that situation, all of the different functions need to be accessible to each other. So the delivery team need to be able to access the project management team, need to be able to access the planning team, the finance team, the commercial team, et cetera, the admin team, whatever it might be. And I think one of the easiest ways to create a team cohesion is to structure that open plan floor effectively. Now, I've seen sometimes that the leaders, who are often sort of like the project management team, will move themselves over into one corner because there is obviously, you know, some stuff that you deal with on your computer screen and stuff might be of a financially sensitive nature or whatever. But actually, I think there's technological means of maintaining that privacy. I think leaders should be in amongst their teams and they should be front and center. So when you walk onto a project office floor, you should be immediately able to identify just by their position in the office who the leaders are. And if you think of it a bit like a Venn diagram, where, you know, you've got the core and then you've got all of the support functions around that that interact with each other and in different ways, I think that's a good model for setting out a floor, because it gets the senior leaders visible, it gets them in amongst them, their teams, it means that they're accessible. And at the end of the day, private conversations can be taken somewhere else. So, you know, there are ways and means to do it. Maybe it is perhaps, as you say, a legacy of the way we've traditionally done things. I would encourage Adam not to change what he's doing. If he's effective in his role and performing how he is, then he should absolutely continue to do that. And maybe if he gets that feedback from a chief exec or from his line manager in the future, you know, just kindly sort of explain to them what his philosophy is and how he feels that gets effective results, and ultimately challenge your line manager to judge you on results rather than on perhaps their subconscious bias towards that situation.
Yes, and I think it can also, if there's a concern that, or will this person be able to make tough decisions if they are too close, then I think, well, let's see if there's some evidence of that before you start worrying about that. If a person is showing that they are leading or managing well, then I think that's, you know, really the strength of the argument to say, well, look, this is why I do it, because we get good performance out of the team. The team get to know me, I get to know them. we can sort things very quickly with communications. There's none of this having to where so and so is, because we're all there, and if we need to have a quick chat, we can just do that. And yeah, who's to say that just because you know people well that you can't make decisions? I mean, we've seen that in the football just recently with yeah, you know, managers go, and they might know people well, but they have to sort of make decisions all the time that might not, you know, that a player might not like, for example. So you know, so they are close to the players, but they also have that distance also then to be able to say, you know, sorry, you're not in the team this week, or but they're making those decisions, even though they know the people well.
And to bring the conversation back to what we talked about in episode 2 about the role of a manager, I talked about the fundamental role of a manager being to get positive outcomes for the organization, and that is done through a mixture of tools. One of which is effective relationship building, which you do with your team, and the other is you know, performance management, because it's never one thing or the other, isn't it? It's you build up that relationship so that you can have that effective performance management conversation with your team in order to get the very best out of them for the business. So absolutely, there needs to be an element of, you know, you are in amongst your team, and you build those strong relationships with your team. But at the same time, also, as we spoke about, you know, you do need to be able to give people feedback where performance issues are not optimum. And you need to have the relationship with your people to be able to effectively do that. And at the end of the day, we talked about as well that as a manager, you represent the business to those people. So, you know, for me, so long as the person is fulfilling all of those criteria, you know, you want them to have a close relationship with their people, and you want them to be able to effectively performance manage their people, and you judge them on those outcomes rather than maybe suggesting up front that there's some sort of an issue. I mean, we've got no reason to suggest that we don't know at what point in the cycle this conversation had happened. You know, if it was straight away, then it's almost like a prejudicial sort of thing. But if it was later on or after a period of time, maybe there was some perceived issues that were arising that made the chief exec make those statements. We don't know. And, you know, if Adam wants to get back in touch and maybe clarify that a little bit, then we'd encourage him to do so. We'd also encourage our listeners who have thoughts on this very issue, or have similar or otherwise experiences, to email us in at podcastandleaders@managershub.com. So thank you, Adam, for your correspondence. By all means, write back to us and just give us a little bit more context to that. I don't know if we answered your question the way you expected us to, but we're all about debate here. So we've opened it up to our listeners, and we'll be very interested to hear your thoughts at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. So, Gary, we've got another bit of correspondence.
Yes, we do, Ray. And this one is from Matt, who has emailed us to say congratulations on a great start and very interesting topics. He says he's enjoyed all the casts and has also passed on the link to others, which is great. Thanks very much, Matt. He says, in regards to the change in audio to cast number 2, without knowing the jargon, he says, I noticed it was set up like a tennis match rather than full stereo, which we may be able to just explain. And then he goes on to ask about coaching, and he says, I'm looking forward to hearing more about coaching, as it's a skill quality I'd very much like to develop in. I remember Ray stating that business in the UK could improve on the application of coaching and ensuring that leaders and managers coach those below them to ensure a subordinate can move up the ladder. Do you think the lack of application is in part due to the concern from a manager or leader that they may be replaced, or they even let their ego prevent coaching? I would suggest, says Matt, that it is generally those with large egos and not those who lack in confidence that achieve a position of manager or leader. And he goes on to say, I assume that coaching would be encouraged to develop the business or individuals in other ways, strengthening knowledge, experience, working in a team, for example, and not just to move up the ladder. Otherwise, the business is likely to lose focus on its core services. Well, there's a lot in there, Matt. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Matt. Interesting, like a tennis match. Yes. And we could give you a technical explanation about it if we actually understood it all ourselves entirely. But, you know, we might do a separate cast on our audio trials and tribulations someday where I can vent my frustration. But maybe not for now. But, you know, glad that you actually, your ears became attuned to it and that you liked it in the end. And we're interested to hear other people's feedback on the audio as well. So he talks about coaching, which is a subject very close to our hearts here at Leaders and Managers Hub. So, Gary, what do you think? What's your initial observations?
Yes, where do we start? So, number of questions there. One was, can the UK improve its application of coaching? Yes. Otherwise, what's the point of being here? If a lack of application, is it partly due to concerns from a manager or leader that they might be replaced? That's an interesting one. I don't know the answer to that, but I do think there may be elements of that because we're all human beings.
Well, we touched upon that briefly in episode 2 when we talked about succession planning and the fact that some managers feel a little bit vulnerable in their position, that if they have excellent performers in their team, that ultimately they may end up being replaced. And that is largely down to a lack of leadership within the organization to make it very clear that at their alpha and omega, an organization must always have the maximum pool of people at any level ready to step up to the next level. And there should always be that constant pressure from underneath for people to progress in the organization.
Yes, we did touch on that. And I think that is an area where, you know, some organizations may find it easier than others to put that into place. And it's maybe because of these perceptions or myths or just the way people are have if you like been taught and educated themselves around what a leader and a manager is and what leadership and management is. So it's certainly not, I think, an easy area, but it is one that companies and organizations do need to address, because as you say, if you are just having it so that we just have people at a set level and nobody moves up or grows or develops, then what happens when you lose a key player, or they move away, or there's a long-term illness? You know, somebody has to fill that vacuum.
Absolutely. And if we use the military experience for a minute, if you're on the battlefield and all of a sudden you lose your sergeant in a company, you don't at that point want them to be looking around your pool of corporals trying to figure out who the person is that's going to step up. You effectively need a number of, you know, sergeants in waiting to be among that pool of corporals to be able to immediately step up into that position. And fundamentally, organizations should value coaching as part of their succession planning, as part of their competency management, because as we've mentioned before, it's a great gauge to understand how competent somebody is at their particular level if they can coach the people beneath them. And often companies, when they get to their annual appraisals and they're looking at their employees and they're saying, okay, well, how do you want to progress for the next 12 months? And often it's about, you know, I'd like to do this training course and I'd like to do that training course. And I've had managers say to me before that they absolutely dread sort of the appraisals because they know that there's going to be a lot of demands for them on training. that they don't necessarily have the budget for. And I've always challenged them back to consider that within an organization, you must have the skills to be able to succeed as an organization. Otherwise, you wouldn't exist at all levels. And therefore, organizations should look an awful lot more closely at coaching as a means of progressing people, because you have the skills within the organization, no matter how big or small the organization is. And therefore, it's a good way of A, measuring that people are unconsciously competent, so that they're able to do their job without even thinking, because they're able to coach other people to do it. And also then for people to make that leap up. I mean, we also referred to the fact that sometimes when people go from a team member to being a team leader, supervisor or manager, that they're not always entirely well prepared for that step up, because it's a different skill set. As part of the coaching model within an organization, those skills could be coached up front, so that you've constantly at any level got loads of people. You want everybody to be striving and driving and pushing at the next level up. I want in, I'm ready for this, I'm good to go. Because you don't want to get to a position where you've got a void and you need to bring somebody up. You want constantly people pushing and driving the organization forward. So it's as much about mindset as anything else. And referring back to Matt's sort of question stroke comment there in his email about should industry be doing more of this in the UK? Absolutely. My experiences from construction, obviously, yours being predominantly from journalism, but not exclusively. And in construction, we haven't done it very well. We are getting hugely better, but we've got a long way to go. I'm very interested to hear from other people in other sectors and understand their experiences of how coaching is used effectively within those sectors, or even within those individual organizations, as a fundamental and key part of their person development program.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were talking earlier there about the sort of skills. So for a new project that I'm helping with, one of the first things somebody said is, oh, we should do a skills audit, just to, so we can see from all our disparate, sort of career paths and what we do, what we've actually got when we put it all together, because we may know some things but not all things. So I thought that was a really good, so not a, it's not being done as a formal thing, because it just because of the nature of the project, but we just thought, oh, that's a really good idea. It's a chance for everybody to get to know, you know, what we have done in the past, what we're doing now, what we can bring to the table, which might be unknown at this point to other people. They might say, well, you know, we know Gary can do the writing and marketing and websites, but there may be other things that Gary does that we don't know. And likewise for the other people, I may know them as, oh, this person does that person does that, but they may have so much more that I don't know about yet.
Yeah, I've had that before in teams that I've managed, where I've just suddenly one day discovered something about somebody that I hadn't previously known. And I thought, oh my God, that, you know, that could be really, really helpful here within this team. Or maybe even somebody expresses an interest in something that they hadn't hitherto done. And like, there's maybe facility within the team and what we're trying to do to give them a little bit of flexibility to be able to pursue that, and maybe even to be able to arrange some coaching for them so that they can get proficient at it. And that's what it's all about. You know, it's we're very quick to say, oh, you're in that role and therefore this is the skill set you need, and that's that. Whereas actually, you know, we should be constantly not just looking to progress people upwards, but also sidewards, because, you know, it might be that somebody suddenly decides that they want to embark in a slightly different role or career within the organization, whereas potentially we might have lost that person to the organization. We actually see that they've got the skills, the basic skills, and the desire to want to make that change. And so absolutely, why wouldn't you look to do that? Because, you know, better to keep a good, enthusiastic employee who just wants a slightly change of direction than potentially to lose them to the business entirely. So Matt goes on to ask some other questions in there, Gary.
Yes, so he was asking about whether it's those with large egos who achieve a position of manager or leader and not those who lack in confidence. And he also asked about whether we sort of assume that sort of coaching is encouraged to develop the business or individuals in other ways, such as strengthening knowledge, experience, working in a team. So those were a couple of the other points he was asking about.
Yeah, so the whole thing about ego is quite interesting, because I've thought about this a lot over the last few days since we received Matt's email, and I think sometimes there can be a misconception that a strong ego is therefore makes a good leader and a strong manager. And it isn't necessarily so. At the end of the day, you know, being arrogant is not a substitute for being competent. And ego is important because I think we all, if we go get back to the whole vulnerability question, you know, we should be stronger, all of us, in terms of our ego. We should be thinking an awful lot more of ourselves, and we should be very proud of ourselves, and we should appreciate our strengths and equally our weaknesses. I understand where Matt's coming from a little bit, in terms of maybe there's a perception that, oh, the bigger egos get to the better positions, rather than being an issue of confidence or indeed competence. Sometimes it's easy to see that or make that assessment. But I think in the most generative organizations, ego actually doesn't come into it, because I think that in progressive organizations, they look for the more rounded person. And an ego is, for me, it's entirely my own opinion, and I welcome challenge to this. Ego is something that's, I liken it visually to something that's on a pedestal, that yes, it's potentially imposing and impressive and everything else, but it's also vulnerable in terms of it can be easily undermined and it can become a target. And I think we've seen in public life that there's a number of big egos out there at the moment that are actually very vulnerable. And it's creating poor judgment and poor decision making. And so I don't think ego in and of itself is sustainable in an effective leadership or management position. I think competence and confidence in that role is much more important. And you can tell the difference between ego and a confidence in your own ability. And I think those things, so a confidence in your own ability has a much stronger foundation. And that allows people to be much more effective leaders and managers, because they're much more comfortable in themselves to work with other people and look at other people for the benefit of those people. We've touched upon before that one of the key roles of leaders and managers is to develop their people. And you need to do that in an empathetic and unbiased way, and without prejudice and without concern for your own vulnerability. Great leaders don't just lead, they create more great leaders. And they do that almost with a selflessness that, defies personal ego. So I'm not quite sure. I mean, I'd be really interested to understand what our listeners think about the whole ego, confidence, competence triangle, if you like. Let's create a triangle out of it, Gary.
Yeah, we should do. I mean, certainly there's something that line between confidence and arrogance, that's certainly one that fascinates me. And then, as you say, it's like, on the one hand, you can see the appeal of someone who's got that the big personality and willing to sort of just say what they think and all that kind of thing. However, then there's also that also is something that needs to be managed as an organization, because if you've got lots of those egos and so on, and they're all vying for, you know, how they see it, that can create enormous tensions at all levels, one level, but across the board, really, and in the boardroom.
Yeah, I mean, even if you imagine if you're a manager out there at the moment and you've got a team of whatever size it might be, you know, just have a little reflection on the people within your team from the perspective of egos, because we've all got one. It's a human thing. We've all got egos of one degree or another. And it's interesting to do an analysis of your team in terms of the ego dynamics within that team, because it might just be, and you hear this sometimes, that, oh, you know, the there's just a clash of personalities. And yes, that is a thing. It does exist. But for me, I think in most cases, these things come down to actually a communication issue. And these things can quite easily be resolved. They don't have to blow up into a big unsolvable problem. I think where you get particular egos involved, that can make things a little bit more difficult, because you're then almost getting into somebody's ideology and beliefs about who they are and who everybody else is. And in transactional analysis, they would talk about it in terms of discounting each other and the I'm okay, you're okay, I'm okay, you're not okay interaction. For any people who are interested in transactional analysis, you'll understand what we mean. Something's going to come up a little bit later that might help you understand about that a little bit more. But it's a tough one, right? Because one person's ego is just another person's opinion, isn't it? And I can understand why sometimes people might have, like with me, thought, oh, he's got a bit of an ego. Yes, I'm opinionated. Absolutely. I'll never, ever shy away from that. But I'd like to think at the same time, I am courageous enough and strong enough to actually accept challenge to my opinions and beliefs. And therefore, I would argue that I have a malleable, flexible ego. But hey, write in and differ. It's entirely up to you. Oh, that was just him. I might have set myself up for a right old hammer in there. Anyway, hey.
We shall see.
We'll see. Hey. So on the coaching people, just not necessarily just to move up the ladder, but to
Just the broader.
Yeah.
So developing the business and individuals in other ways. So as a development tool or process, I guess.
So I, in my experience, have been very fortunate as a project manager to, obviously you work with other people who are specialists. So maybe finance specialists, commercial specialists, planning specialists, etc. And these are all things that I wouldn't necessarily need to be 100% proficient at, i.e. a specialist myself, in order to progress up the ladder. But I found it for my own personal development hugely beneficial to work around these people, because every day I learn something that I didn't know before. And whether it's something that helps me in my work life or in my out of work life or whatever, I probably get more. I'm a bit of a vampire when it comes to people's knowledge and experience. I love talking to people and I love learning from people. And I don't think I've ever been in a situation where I've had an interaction that I didn't learn something from, whether it was a direct coaching. But I have had in the past where, you know, I've been in a role in a project and I've gone to somebody outside of that role and said, look, you do this, I'm interested in that, could you give me a bit of coaching on it? Because I don't necessarily want to do that role full time, but I'd love to understand a little bit more about it for my own professional development, so that when I'm sitting in meetings, it's not all going entirely over my head. So I think there is definitely some value in that. An example I'll give is when I used to work as an installation manager on signaling projects, I had no interest in testing. It's not really my bag. I don't have the right mentality for it, apart from anything else. But I did spend a lot of time with the testing teams and trying to understand how they went about their business, because they did things in a way that was not natural to me. And so I thought, well, I want to try and challenge myself to try that and learn from them and be coached by them, just to give me a slightly different perspective. And it was very interesting. It didn't make me want to get into testing any more than I had done previously. But I just found it fascinating, and it actually just gave me slightly different perspectives and actually helped me to understand how what I did impacted on them and what I could do slightly better in my installation manager role that would benefit them as the people who took on the installation from me and took it through testing commissioning. So that was quite interesting. Have you had any experiences like that?
From a general marketing perspective, I would say one of the things that many businesses would benefit from is having their marketing team talk more to their sales team, and their sales team talk more to their marketing team, so that they can really understand each other a lot better and how they can help each other a lot better. I think that's a sort of general bit of advice I would give. In my own copywriting and marketing, again, with clients, although I quite often am writing for them, or that I'm reviewing things for them, I also look at things strategically for them, and I'm able to ask questions about themselves and their business, which is a form of coaching. It's a coaching approach to understanding themselves and their business and their products and their services better, so that then they're more able or better able to express what it is that they do and the difference they make, why people should be working with them. So I certainly use that as an approach. So I'm not telling them what to do or what they should say. It's allowing them to express it, and then I can say that sounds good, or that which sounds like there's something in what you're saying there, or that's clear, that's not clear, that's in line with what you told me about your values and your principles, but where you've said this on this other page, that doesn't seem to fit. It's because you're talking about something else. Or they might have in the past, for example, used a form of branding or wording just to describe themselves, and then they've kind of moved on to something else, but they're still using bits of the old. So now suddenly you've got, well, I'm this, oh, and I'm also this. So you have to be, I sort of advise them about how that might look to somebody if they're reading that and then they see that. Could you see how there might be some confusion for that person? They're thinking, well, what are you then?
Yeah.
So I suppose there's a couple of examples there.
Well, you also, in, I think it was episode 2, you talked about an experience you'd had where you kind of became like a sub-editor for the day, and you got the opportunity to lay out a center spread, and the person was sort of talking you through the process and allowing you to have a go. Not necessarily because you aspired to move up in that direction, but for you as a journalist and an individual contributor, it gave you a perspective on what you produced and how somebody uses that on the next part of the process, and maybe gave you food for thought about maybe how you would do things to improve that overall flow through the process.
Yes, and big shout out to Scarlett, who's now over in the States, and not in sub-editing, in the education field. But yes, that approach that she took in training me to become a sub-editor, and this is kind of the old school sub-editing, so not with all the modern technology they have now. This was the old pen and paper and glue and
stone and chisel,
all that kind of stuff. But yeah, just someone who either instinctively or perhaps just with me said, this is how we're going to do it, because that's a way to really allow somebody to sort of just get into something without the pressure of learning stuff which was important. Yes, of course, you need to understand the technical side of things, but actually that wasn't her philosophy. Was that, you know, it's the look of the pages. When people open that page, it's like, you know, they need to be grabbed by the pictures, by the headlines. That needs to draw them in. You know, if you fail to do that, doesn't matter how good the stories are, people will have just switched over to the next page, finding the next thing that will catch their eye. So being able to just start from that very creative side where it's just, yeah, don't worry about anything, just start with the pictures, put them how you think it might go on the page, how you'd like them on the page, and then we'll just go from there. Just a simple...
Yeah, and I guess, like, so for listeners who aren't maybe necessarily currently in a leadership or management position, who maybe aspire to, just to sort of bring it into perspective, what we mean by coaching. So a lot of people's experience of coaching is from, like, sports coaching, say for football, where you've got the coach on the side of the pitch, you know, screaming and bawling, you know, run faster, kick it, head it, you know, pass it, all that sort of thing. It's a little, tends to be, well, hopefully it's a little bit more sedate in like the work environment. And it's more about, so for example, like Gary's just explained, you know, he was producing copy for a newspaper, and this editor just supported him to show how you would put a center page spread together. And it was kind of, well, you do it how you would do it, and then we'll talk about it, and I'll give you some feedback on, you know, maybe ways you could improve it or how it all fits in. So coaching is not the same as training, and it's not the same as I'm going to tell you precisely how to do it and this is what you do. It's more about encouraging people to try things out for themselves within a certain framework. In this case, the framework being the page. And then seeing how, putting their personal slant on it. If there are, it's not always easy, because in some respects, in some roles, there are technical requirements that you have to meet, for example. But it's more about letting people have a go. Imagine if you've got a child and you say to a child, you know, draw me a fish. And the child draws you a fish, but probably, you know, the first go at it might not exactly represent a fish. So, you know, you might say, well, how would the fish see? Okay, so it would be eyes. So let's draw some eyes. Let's show where the eyes would be. How would the fish swim? So let's draw some fins and that sort of thing. It's more about bringing people's knowledge and experience out of them into whatever the application is, as opposed to just saying, you do, you do, you do. And so that's fundamentally what we mean by coaching. And the examples we've given previously, because we will talk a lot about coaching continuously, and we make no apologies for that, is that it's all about making sure that people are better today than they were yesterday, and that they're prepared to be better tomorrow than they are today in terms of their role. So it might be, for example, you have a project manager or an assistant project manager who's coming up through the ranks. And one of the things you might do is you might do some coaching with them on effective meeting behaviors. Because one of the things I've seen in the United Kingdom is that our meeting behaviors aren't fantastic, and we don't always have effective meetings. So it might be that. It might be that you're going to be working on a project that is remote. So it might be coaching on how to run an online meeting, a video conference meeting, or a telephone conference meeting. And it might, you know, it might encompass all of things like room setting and protocols and rules and all that sort of thing. So it's really about developing the skills, the core non-technical skills. Because if somebody requires to operate a particular piece of machinery, you won't coach that. You'll give them some direct training on that. You know, you press that button, you press that button. This is how it operates. This is what you do in the event of an emergency, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The coaching around that might come along the lines of, okay, so you're operating that piece of plant, and ultimately you aspire to be a supervisor of the team that's operating that plant. So while you're doing your day job, I'm going to give you some coaching on how we do the report writing, maybe bring you into a couple of the meetings where we talk about, you know, progress and change and all these sorts of things, so that you can get comfortable with the environment and start to prepare you for that next step up while you increase your competence at doing that particular task. So in relation to what to Matt's question, absolutely, we would encourage coaching, not just for a means of climbing ladders. I think everybody should constantly be challenging. I mean, I've had examples before in the past, Gary, where coaching hasn't been given to me. I have sought it out. So I've been in a role and I've spoken to my line manager and I've said, oh, you know, they're doing something over there that I'm quite interested in doing. Could I spend an hour or two a week with them just to get to understand what they're doing for my own development? So don't always wait for coaching to be brought to you. Seek it out. Find it out. Get involved in Leaders and Managers Hub. We will have all sorts of interesting people in the community that we can all learn from. And, you know, one of the things we all have in common is that we're quite happy to share our expertise and our experience. So seek it out, you know, listen to the podcasts. When we get into some of the conferencing and stuff like that, seek it out as well. You know, we'll all learn stuff, access things like the manager tools guys in the US, because there's some great models that they've got on there for individual tools and stuff like that. And constantly be asking, you know, can I have some coaching on this? That's a particular skill I'd like to develop. Can I have some coaching on that? My experience recently with coaching has been through psychotherapy. So I see a psychotherapist here in Folkestone every Wednesday evening. And that's where I'm getting a lot of my transactional analysis stuff from.
Yeah.
She is not about telling me, Ray, you need to do this, you need to do that. Literally, she just puts stuff out there and sort of draws me into it, or allows me to get to those conclusions myself by challenging. Quite often it's challenging, you know. And one of the things I've really benefited from is she has opened up this whole field of transactional analysis to me that I have then gone on to research quite a lot more. And it's absolutely fascinating. And so we spend most of our sessions actually talking about what I have learned in the week. It's almost like a summary sort of, okay, so Ray, what have you learned in the week? And, you know, I'll talk through, oh, well, I tried this and I did that and this is how it felt and this was the experience and stuff like that. Mm. It's not about, Ray, you need to do this now and you need to do that now. And I don't know that coaching comes naturally to people all the time, Gary. And maybe it is that organizations need to also give people a little bit of coaching in how to be coaches.
Yeah, for
because,
sure.
You know, you get really effective coaches and so not effective coaches. And coaching as well needs to be a two-way thing. So it needs to be a for the benefit of the coachee, the person being coached, but also for the benefit of the coach, because it reinforces their knowledge and understanding of that particular thing as well, and is a massive confidence grower, but could also, if it didn't necessarily go very well, could be a confidence debilitator. So perhaps organizations need to do a little bit on coaching and a little bit of formal training on coaching to allow people to be more effective in the coaching experience. Because good people who are coached well quite often become good coaches themselves, because they see how it's done effectively.
And then there's the, you know, bringing in external coaches as well, who can bring a different dynamic to the situation.
Yeah, because I'm collaborating with some people on a couple of meetup groups who are therapeutic coaches, and they use all sorts of different techniques around coaching. And again, it's, you know, it's not about getting people into your therapy room and telling them what they need to do to lead a better life. It's about allowing people or supporting people to get to basically to get to where they know they need to be, but don't necessarily realize it up front, and to realize their potential and maybe overcome some of the anxieties and vulnerabilities that they perceive. I'm actually looking to try and get a couple of these said coaches to either come and do interviews with us, or maybe even, you know, be ad hoc contributors to the show, because for me, coaching is a massive subject, as I say, that we're going to come back to and back to all the time. And again, we encourage people to write in and give their experiences of coaching. Are they effective coaches? Come in and talk to us about what it is that they do particularly well or they feel is incredibly effective. Would they like to be more effective coaches? Maybe we can see about how we could set up maybe a coaching workshop or something for people, or maybe do something online, maybe through a webinar or something like that. There's all sorts of things we can do to support people with coaching. Any other business time, Gary?
Yes, this is a little bit of a plug for TEDx Folkestone, if I may.
Go for it.
And if this is coming out when we think it is, then you may just have time, because on Tuesday, 3rd of December, there is a launch event at the Aleto Chocolate Cafe in Rendezvous Street, Folkestone, from 6 p.m. And that is to give people a chance to find out more about TEDx Folkestone and the kinds of opportunities that are being made available to people who want to help with putting together the 2020 event and beyond. So anybody who has any interest in a TEDx project, who is reasonably local, you don't actually have to live in Folkestone, but as long as you're close enough to be able to you know, put some time in to help out, there are all sorts of roles around the planning, the organizing, the management, marketing, a film team, all sorts of opportunities. So if whether people have got a little bit of time or a lot of time, or they're looking to get involved in something where they can give back but also use their skills, we would love to see people there Tuesday, December the 3rd, 6 p.m. at the cafe. And if they can't make that, that's fine. All they need to do is go to the TEDxFolkestone.com website, and if they just drop us a line there and let us know that they're interested in volunteering, we can take it from there.
Yeah, well, I'm coming along on that Tuesday evening as well. So yeah, that should be quite an interesting event, actually. I'm not going along there with any particular desire to volunteer, purely because of a time element issue, constraint, call it what you will. I haven't got enough time. But I'm always interested in these sorts of events and just sort of getting to meet people and have conversations and stuff. I'm maybe going to try and drag a couple of people onto the show as well. Who knows? You know, we might be able to do a bit of mutual marketing and plugging. Who knows?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, even if you just come along out of curiosity, you might think, well, that's not for me, but you may know someone you think that is perfect for them. So you can just share it out. And I say that because there's some, you know, changes going on within the structure of the team, you know, there will be some opportunities for people who, you know, if somebody is interested in, you know, being at the sort of very highest level of working on the project, there's scope for that. And if you're sort of just looking at something which is maybe helping out with, you know, social media, for example, you know, that's something as well. And there will be actual proper job descriptions for some of the roles that are going to become available. So
and just to make it clear, Gary, this isn't for speakers. That's going to come separately in time, and we'll obviously announce that when that's all coming out. This is for people who are in the supporting and behind the scenes roles.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the volunteer team that actually make TEDx Folkestone happen. So the recruitment for speakers, that is probably not going to take place until sort of New Year or early into 2020. So. But if people are interested in the speaker side, just hold on to your hats. And again, the best thing to do is to, if you sign up to the newsletters and news on the TEDxFolkestone.com website, you'll get all the messages saying when things are happening relevant to you.
Perfect. Or any other business for you?
That's plenty, I think, for now.
Okay. I've got a few. So again, a big thank you to people who've emailed the show and people who've contacted us privately to give feedback. We love you all. It's amazing that people are actually taking the time to listen to us, and we are astoundingly grateful that anybody even listens to us. But you know, fantastic, we love you all. Thank you very much for that, and keep it coming. Just a reminder to people, however you access your podcasts, we're now on Spotify, we're also on Apple Podcasts through iTunes. Subscribe or follow, whatever the particular term that they use on that particular platform is. Rate, review, tell your friends about us. Pass us around the place like an old rag doll. You can also access us through my company website at www.campionconsultants.uk. There's an embedded player in there that you can hear all the episodes as well. Had some really good feedback from the Dave Burton interview as well. Fantastic. And again, just a reminder, email in any questions that you'd like to send Dave's way to podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. Just a note to say that alongside this episode, we've also got an interview with Andrew Munn from Lunatus Resourcing coming out on the same day. So please feel free to access that. Hope you enjoy that too. And similarly, if you want to send some correspondence through to Andrew, the details, his contact details will be there for you, or you can always email us at leadersandmanagershub.com. On the social media side, so Bella's been beavering away in the background trying to get all the social media set up. We've now added that to the Campion Consultants website. So on the Leaders and Managers Hub descriptor that's in there, the article, at the bottom of that, you'll have all the links to our social media like Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook. Again, give us a like, give us a wave. Whatever it is you do on these different platforms, and we'll give you a nod back. I'm sure we'll be able to keep Bella pretty busy trying to juggle all that. And then just on the last thing is we have a little bit of a competition, Gary.
Ooh.
Yeah. Our very first Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast competition. So I alluded to it earlier. I'm getting into transactional analysis in quite a big way. It's a fascinating subject. And I've been reading a book called The Transactional Manager. Now, it's a book that was suggested to me by my very good friend Julia. And so I bought it on Audible. And it's absolutely fascinating. Now, I've been trying to get an actual physical book as well. But I can't get any new ones on Amazon, and Waterstones, it says that they just don't have them. So I think it might actually be out of print. It is quite an old book. And the reason I wanted to get the hard copies was because within it, there are some diagrams that if you're new to transactional analysis, you wouldn't necessarily understand by the audio descriptor that comes with the audio book. But I've been unable to get hold of those. I will continue to try, but for the purposes of this competition, we are going to make available to you the Audible version of the book. So for the first 5 listeners who email into us at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com, give us your top 5 leadership or management titles that you have read or you've reviewed, you've heard about, you're interested in, send them in on an email. And the first five emails that we get after this podcast comes out, so after the 2nd of December, we will gift you, in time for Christmas, a audiobook version of The Transactional Manager. As a little bit of a Christmas gift from us to you with love.
Sounds good.
Yeah, well, you know, we've got to try and, you know, share the love. And it is coming up to Christmas after all. So what we'll do is we'll announce who those five lucky people are on episode 4 when it comes out on the 16th of December. So look forward to that. So please email us in with any of your correspondence, any suggestions, feedback, experiences. We want to hear about it all. Okay, that's it for episode 3, Gary.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much. And be good, be safe, and we'll catch you very, very soon. It's just so incredible. Gotta have it, can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know that this is incredible. Now, have you ever wondered how the best did it? They never second guessed, they didn't set limits. Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission, listen, it's beyond description. We don't wanna fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need a brand of passion that you can't imagine. Don't hesitate, rub the lamp a lad. It's just so incredible. Gotta have it, can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know.